Okay, thank you everybody for coming. I want to thank Mrs. Kahan. This is her first time giving one of the Parsha Shirim. She is the principal of Mayanot for the last 7 years. Mayanot was started by many people in this shul, and it's one of the to Rinat Mayanot, it's very close to people's heart. But either way, she's a great darshanit, and we look forward to hearing your Torah.
Thank you. Well, thank you for inviting me to learn with you tonight. It's really a treat. And to be doing something on Thursday night other than being in my kitchen. So thank you for inviting me to learn with you. I wanted to talk today about a question that was raised for me recently by a student, Ira Prager, who I believe Davin's in the shul, who had a very interesting question and it really made me think. So I wanted to talk about it together, propose a few solutions, and hear other perspectives as well. Very often, I'll try to speak up. Very often, people are troubled by the end of the Megillah, by the sort of the tone of bloodthirstiness and vengeance at the end of the Megillah, the emphasis on an exaltation at the fall of our enemies, as in the first source, which we don't need to read together. These are some of the psukim where you can sort of see that sense of rejoicing at the demise of our enemies. But her question was actually a little bit different. Her question was how to understand the reason for this, the contrast between this sense that we have on Purim and in the Megillah specifically, and the sense that we develop in Pesach of that Masa Yadai Tovim Bayam, that we have a sense of compassion for our enemies on Pesach, and how do we sort of understand the difference in reaction in these two scenarios. Obviously, the whole issue of our reaction to the destruction of enemies of Yivcha al Tismach is a topic that's been discussed in many contexts. But her question was really specifically about these two stories. How do we understand the difference in reaction between these two stories and our commemoration of them on the two holidays? So just to give a little bit of background, we'll go through this quickly because I think these sources are familiar to people. The second source is the Gemara in Megillah, which is one of the places in the Gemara where that idea of Masa Yadai Tovim Bayam comes up. It's based on the pasuk in Devarim, which is in source 3, of V'hayaka Asher Sas Hashem Aleichem Lehitiv Eschem. And the Gemara asks how we understand that. This is from the story of Yehoshaphat and Devarim Bet. Ve'omrim hodu l'Hashem ki tov ki le'olam chasdo. Ve'amar Rabbi Yochanan v'pnei malo ne'amar ki tov v'hoda azo. Why does it leave out the words ki tov? L'fi she'en HaKadosh Baruch Hu sameach l'mapaltah shel rishaim. And then it brings the example of Pesach. The same thing with Shir HaShirim. Lo karav ze el ze kol halayla. That source is in source 4. That pasuk. Bikshu malachi asharis l'mar shira. Amar HaKadosh Baruch Hu masa yaday tovim b'yam. Ve'atem omrim shira. And then the conclusion of the Gemara is that Hashem himself doesn't rejoice, but he makes other people happy with the fall of Rishayim. So I think that source is familiar to us, but I think it's worth looking at in this context. And of course, this is all connected to the pasuk that I mentioned earlier from Mishle. Sorry, did you have a question?
I have a sort of question about the underlying theme.
Yeah.
And that is that I don't think Pesach is so clear that it's really different from Purim.
Mm-hmm.
Because the sources that you just quoted was that God tells the angels, must say, you're dying. But the Jewish people, they were singing those verses.
Right.
So the people were acting very similarly, I think, to the way that the Jews acted in Purim. So I don't see the contrast. I see the contrast with God and with Malachim, but not with the Jews.
Right. So I think, so that's certainly true, and sources discuss that, the fact that we did say Shiras Hayam, right? So clearly, that's a conclusion of the Gemara, that Hashem himself isn't happy, but he makes people happy in Mapatan Shel Rishayim. That's for sure true. And sources discuss that and suggest that perhaps it's because if a person himself experiences the Yeshua, then he can rejoice, or that if it's not in the moment, but after a delay of time, looking back on the Yeshua, a person can rejoice that the Malachi Asharis wanted to do it right then as they were drowning, not at the end afterwards. That's definitely true. At the same time, we have the reason that I think it's still a good question, although we'll see one source that agrees with you that it's not a good question, is there are two reasons that I think the question stands. One is that the source in Mishle, if we look into those psukim carefully, when it says "binfulayivcha al tismach," so it's, first of all, it is commanding a person, right? I mean, if we connect these two sources, and this is the source that's quoted by our Gemara, "ubekisha lo al yageli becha," this is said as a command to people. "Pen yireh Hashem v'rabe ina v'hishiv me'alav apo." So I think the idea here is that we might have a natural instinct to rejoice at the fall of Rishayim, and maybe that's even understandable, but it's sort of lo na'im in Hashem's eyes. Like, he may look at it and not be pleased with it. I think that's what the psukim are implying here. And additionally, halachically, in Surah 7, we have the well-known Beis Yosef, who quotes the Shibolei Haleket as saying that the reason we say only Chatzi Halel on Chol HaMoed in the last days is because our simcha is not complete. So even though I think you're absolutely right that there's not an exact correlation between Hashem and the Malachi Asharis, or what Hashem allows the Malachi Asharis to do and what the Bnei Yisrael do, at the same time, I think there is a theme here that it's just preferable not to rejoice in the fall of one's enemies, to the point that we may even, according to this idea from the Shibolei Haleket, have a halachic ramification of saying Chatzi Halel, at least to try to instill within ourselves that instinct, even if we don't feel that way at all times. Yes?
Okay, so we have but after the Kriyas Yamsuf, we have Oz Yoshe Moshe Bnei Yisrael. And then we have Vatan Lahem Miriam, Suka Macholos, Shir Lad Hashem. So obviously, there's a time to sing and there's not the time not to sing.
Right, absolutely. I think there are different perspectives, different people within the story who might where there might be different appropriate reactions. But at the same time, I think that this emphasis on this theme, both in the Gemara and halachically, with the idea that we say Chatzi Halel, perhaps, for this reason, is telling us that this is a valuable idea to keep in mind for Pesach. And as you say, of course, this is not so clear-cut, right, because of the reasons that you mentioned, and also in Source 6 we have another pasuk from Mishle that seems to say the opposite. But to tzadikim ta'alot kiriya uva ovad rishayim rinad, there is song when rishayim perish. So it's certainly not completely straightforward. At the same time, it seems to me that there is a difference in emphasis in the themes of the Megillah and the Pesach story, or Purim and Pesach. I do want to start with one source that disagrees before we return to the question, which is Source 8, the Meshech Chachma. Very interesting Meshech Chachma, where he says that he starts off by saying that Uladati had Amar Lahem Atad Dabar Shal Doros Hu Lahorosh Shlemus Mitzvah Yisparach Ki Kol Ha'ami Mitasosei Ha'minimusios Yasum Yom Nitzachon Yom Apalasei Vehem Lachol Kachad Ha'nitzachon. He says, in general, nations have this tendency to have a festive day when their enemies are destroyed. Lo kein bi Yisrael. That's not what Jews do. And he says, Hema lo yismuchu al mapalas oveihem. They don't rejoice when their enemies are destroyed. V'lo yachugu b'simcha al zeh. Kamosh amar bin ful oyivcha al tismach. He quotes the pasuk from Mishle, and the continuation of the pasuk. And he gives a few examples. So skipping down to the underlined parts, he says, that's why on Chag HaPesach, we don't say that it's Chag, the Torah doesn't say Chag HaMatzos ki bo aseh b'Mitzrayim shvatim, that the reason is because Hashem did miracles against Mitzrayim on that day. Rather, we say the reason that we celebrate Chag HaMatzos is ki hotzi Hashem es b'nei Yisrael m'Mitzrayim. We celebrate this holiday because Hashem redeemed us. And that's really what we focus on more than the destruction of our enemies. And the same about Nes Chanukah. He says that's why on Nes Chanukah we don't focus on the military aspect as much as on the Nes Pach HaShemen, because the Nes Pach HaShemen sort of shows that Hashem was with us. It's this spiritual message, and that's really what we want to focus on and not on the destruction of our enemies. And he actually brings Purim as a support. He says that in the last underlying part, V'chein b'neis Purim lo asu yom tov b'yom shenit nitlahaman o b'yom shahargu besonehem. That's why we don't have Purim on the day that they actually killed their enemies and hanged Haman. Kizet in simcha lifnei amo Yisrael. This isn't what makes Jews happy. Rak hayom biyom tov hu b'yamim asher nachu me'oyvehem. But only, rather, the holiday was on the day that they rested, that they had reprieve, the next day, the day after. I always think that's actually an interesting thing to look into, like, do different countries have their independence days on the day that they want or the next day? It was sort of an interesting question. But so he's actually agreeing with you that it's not, he's rejecting the premise of the question, but in the opposite direction, right? He's saying that both, he's not saying that Pesach is like Purim in that we rejoice in the destruction of our enemies. He's saying Purim is like Pesach and that we don't rejoice in the destruction of our enemies. So he agrees that there's not a distinction, but actually the opposite direction from what you are suggesting. So I think it's worthwhile knowing. Any reactions to that source? I'm curious what you think about that. Okay. I think it's worth recognizing that you could certainly look at this in a number of ways. You could either reject the premise of the question by saying Purim is actually like Pesach, or Pesach is like Purim. But I like the question. I think it's a good question. I think these are different themes in the holidays. And so I want to discuss five potential approaches to resolving this difference. Okay? The first few approaches I'm going to suggest would indicate that there was something unique about Mitzrayim such that we don't rejoice at the fall of the Mitzrayim, the way that we would normally. In other words, that Purim is a little more normative, and that there was something unique about Mitzrayim that would set it aside, that would make us say, Binfol Oyivcha Al Tismach, specifically about Pesach. Okay? The first thing that I want to suggest is that there is a complex relationship between Bnei Yisrael as a whole, and specifically Moshe Rabbeinu, and Mitzrayim, such that there were significant enough positive aspects to the relationship that we wouldn't just be happy when the Mitzrayim are destroyed. So for example, so under approach number one, we have, of course, the pasuk in Devarim, l'tote'ev adomi ki achichahu, lo tote'ev mitzri ki ger hayita b'artzo, that we have a mitzvah not to hate Mitzrayim, because they did give us shelter when we needed it. But what I think is even more interesting is to look into the relationship of Moshe Rabbeinu with Mitzrayim. So in source number 10, when we see the psukim about how Moshe was adopted by Bat Paro, how he was given a name by Bat Paro, she does these acts that are always associated with parenthood in Tanakh. So clearly it seems that his relationship with Mitzrayim, even Klal Yisrael as a whole, and certainly Moshe's relationship with Mitzrayim, has some very positive elements to it. And then in source number 11, is what I think it's a very interesting source. This is the Sforno on the Sneh. He's discussing the symbolism of what the Sneh represented to Moshe Rabbeinu. And he said, and so the way that he describes it is that ze derech chidat hanevuah, this was a sort of a riddle of nevuah, that the malach within the sneh, right, we have the malach, we have the sneh, and we have the fire. So he says, the malach betoch hasneh, va'esh bo'er besneh saviv hamalach, lohorot shebiyot tzadike Yisrael, shehe malachei Hashem, betoch hasneh shel am Mitzrayim, shehayu lehem saravim uslonim, hasneh yivayar be'esh batzaret eser makot, avalo yuchlu ba'otan hatzarot. So what he's saying is that the malach represents Bnei Yisrael, and the sneh is Mitzrayim, and the fire is the Eser Makot. So Bnei Yisrael are trapped in Mitzrayim, and Mitzrayim is suffering through the Eser Makot, but Mitzrayim is not destroyed. So he's saying that the fundamental idea of the sneh was that Mitzrayim won't be destroyed. Like, how is that a good message, right? How does that help anybody? I brought this up. This is actually an idea that also another one of my students, I wish I could remember which one, suggested that the first time I asked this question, I said, like, why is that the message Moshe needed to hear at that moment? That, don't worry, Mitzrayim won't be destroyed. And she said, because maybe that really was what he was most afraid of at that moment, in a certain way. Maybe that was part of what was frightening about taking on this shlichut, is he had this very warm relationship with Bat Paro. He had grown up in Mitzrayim. He was identified as an Ish Mitzri when he got to Midian. And maybe the idea that what he's being sent to do is going to ultimately destroy Mitzrayim, maybe that really was part of his fear. And maybe that was an important message for him to hear at that moment. And so I think that idea, that if we read the Sforno that way, is indicating that even at that moment, Moshe had this sort of complex and in some ways positive association with Mitzrayim. It could maybe help us understand how Mitzrayim specifically, both for Klal Yisrael and specifically for Moshe Rabbeinu, would be a situation in which we would not be happy about their destruction. Yes?
Yeah. Number 11, line number 2.
Yeah.
At the end, what does Reverend Salama mean?
That's an expression from Navi. It's an expression from Navi. It refers to thorns and thistles, like different, you know, that like Mitzrayim was like thorns to Bnei Israel, like stuck in their side.
Scott?
Yes.
You have a model for that.
Mm-hmm.
Vayicha Yitro.
Mm-hmm.
Vayicha could be Chiva.
Mm-hmm.
Rashi said Nasa, B'sao, Chigdim, Chidudim.
Mm-hmm.
Why? Because we found out that the culture of Mitzrayim is gone.
Mm-hmm.
The idea of his son feeling that way that you just brought up. Not completely out of
model, is there? Right, it exists in the Yitrosa. Excellent point. Okay, so that could be one approach to understanding why it would be that specifically in Mitzrayim we would not be happy about the destruction of enemies, but maybe in other cases, including Purim, and this would make Purim the more normative approach, we would be. Okay, here's a second approach, also along those lines, that Mitzrayim is the exception. So another idea that I think one could say to support why it would be that in Mitzrayim specifically we wouldn't rejoice is because of the ways that the sources traditional sources tend to understand the spiritual level character of Bnei Yisrael in Mitzrayim, which is not so positive. In general, there is an idea in all kinds, you know, in Parshanut, but you know, in all kinds of Parshanut, about that Bnei Israel really weren't worthy of Yitziat Mitzrayim, but it was a huge chesed. I mean, bring midrash after midrash along these lines, that it was a tremendous chesed that Hashem brought them out. They really weren't deserving. So, for example, in Source 12, these are the psukim about having to put the Dam al Hamashkof, the blood on the doors, which sort of indicates that perhaps they needed to set themselves apart in some way because it wasn't so obvious what the difference between Bnei Israel and Mitzrayim were. Or in Source 13, this is the Netziv, who takes a very harsh perspective on Bnei Israel's status and the way that their identity in Mitzrayim. He says, on the pasuk in Shmot Aleph, "Atimalei ha'aretz otam," that the land became filled with them, which in pshat just means there were a lot of them. So he says, no, really, the whole land became filled with them. They completely assimilated. They moved in everywhere. And he brings as a proof. He says that's why Hashem had to pasach al ha'petach, had to jump over their houses because they were so mixed up with the rest of Mitzrayim. They were really living all together. And he brings in the Midrash that from Shmot Rabbah that once Yosef died, they began assimilating and they stopped doing Bris Milah and they moved out of Goshen. So the ideas here are that Bnei Israel as a whole were really not deserving of Yitziat Mitzrayim. And I think if we apply this to our question, we could suggest that the reason that they weren't meant to rejoice, or that it wasn't, they did ultimately rejoice with Shiras Hayam, but that there's this idea of not rejoicing on Pesach, the destruction of enemies, it's almost like, it reminds me in like Source 14 of Lot's wife, right? That she wasn't supposed to turn around and look and take any kind of pride in the fact that she was getting out and everyone else wasn't, because she really shouldn't have gotten out either, right? That's at least one way of understanding the pshat. The idea is like it's just not appropriate for her to look back and see other people's destruction when really she should have been among those destroyed. And I think we could apply that here as well and say perhaps Pesach is different. We have a specific idea of not rejoicing in the destruction of our enemies because we should recognize that really we too should have been there as well, right? There was no reason. This was a tremendous chesed that Hashem did for Bnei Israel, but it's not something that we deserved. And so we shouldn't look back and say like, oh, look what happened to them. Okay? All right. Feel free to jump in if you have questions, thoughts, ideas. Okay. This is my favorite one. This is the third approach. This I actually find the most compelling, but curious what everyone thinks about it. So this also is along the lines of that Mitzrayim was a bit of an exception. There was something unique about Mitzrayim that made it particularly tragic that the Mitzrayim were destroyed. So one of the unique aspects of Yitziat Mitzrayim, and specifically Kriyat Yam Suf, is the intense involvement in a very obvious and direct and really unparalleled way in all of Tanakh of Hashem in a very open, miraculous type of way. And this, of course, stands in complete contrast to Purim, where, as we all know, Hashem's name doesn't even appear in the Megillah. And it's much more sort of like within nature and politics and people's machinations that everything happens within the Megillah. So I'd like to suggest that there was a particular sort of poignancy, human tragedy, in the destruction of the Mitzrayim, because it was like the Yotzer, the creator, had to destroy his own creation in such an obvious way. The idea that Hashem had to like, Ma'ase yadai tovim bayam, right? The creations that I made, I'm like drowning them in the sea right now. Like that's what it's about. That there's something just tragic about having to see the creator turn against his creation in such an obvious way. That even in Purim, so Hashem was running the whole picture, of course, Hashem runs the world, but at least it wasn't like quite so direct, the way in which he had to destroy his own creations. And that we're meant to look at that and say, like, that's not good. That's not what we want. That's a tragedy when that happens. And it reminds me most poignantly, if we want to think about a parallel sort of emotion in Tanakh, of source 15, of the story of David and Avshalom, where David has to turn against Avshalom, right? He has to fight against him. But there's a real sense of tragedy and loss in his needing to do so. And we see, and I underline some of the most significant psukim, that when the messengers come to ask David, I mean, to tell David what happened with Avshalom, and he continually asks, Shalom lanar la Avshalom. Like, is it okay for Avshalom? Is he all right? And when he's finally told that he's not all right, when the Cushi says to him, everyone who turns against you should get the same fate that he did. And so, you know, David in this very poignant pasuk that we're familiar with, but I think every time I read it, it strikes me how moving it is. And he gets upset. He's vayirgaz hamelech, and he goes to the aliyat hashar vayev, and he cries v'cho amar belechto bini Avshalom bini Avshalom mi yitein muti ani tachtecha Avshalom bini. Right, this sense of like, this is what I needed to do. But this is terrible. This is never what I wanted. I wish it would have been me instead. And I think that perhaps that same emotion is what we're meant to think about when we imagine the image of Hashem drowning his own creatures in such an open way, in such a miraculous and obvious divine intervention. That we're supposed to recognize that wasn't what we ever really wanted. That was the bad scenario, right?
Do you see anything like that in the text, but it's still...
Right, interesting.
It's the same kind.
It is the same kind of thing. Yeah, I don't think so. Good point. I wonder why that would be. Yeah, it's interesting. No, I guess not. Although we do have the idea of not looking back at them. Right, so maybe you could say that that's the parallel, is like no one was supposed to look back and see the destruction. Interesting. Okay. So those are all... Sorry. Yeah, go ahead.
During the Makos, it says that Hashem really is trying to
You mean B'nai Yisrael not doing the job?
Yeah.
In what way do you mean?
It's kind of a combination of the other, together with this one. Mm-hmm. That had they done the job of bringing God's name to the world and about his presence and about what he's doing, mm-hmm. then there wouldn't have to have been destruction of the Egyptians, mm-hmm. of his creations.
Right. Yeah, so it's sort of a combination of a couple of those approaches. Interesting. So maybe there's also meant to be a shame in it, that like, and maybe similar to what... maybe similar even to what David may have felt also in that situation. Okay, good. So those were all a few approaches that, again, sort of set Mitzrayim as being distinct and would imagine that that Purim is a little bit more normative. I want to look at a couple of other approaches that are different than that. So approach number four, I think, is really very straightforward. The idea that, and this supports the idea that Purim is actually unusual, is not the typical case, that there's an emphasis throughout the Purim story on the national conflict involved between Haman and Mordechai, which represent Amalek and B'nai Yisrael. This is well known in source number 16. As soon as we're introduced to Haman, we are introduced to him as Ha'agagi, that he represents Amalek, he represents Agag, who's from Amalek. In source 17, another example of this is just a pshat. Of course, there are many examples of this in Parshanut and in Midrashim. where Zeresh and Kol Ohavav say to Haman that Imi Zerah Yehudi Mordechai Asher Hachilos Alim Pol Lefanav Lo Tuchal Ki Nafolti Pol Lefanav. They cast this as very much a national struggle, a national conflict. This is not just between you and Mordechai. This is between you and what you represent nationally and what Mordechai represents nationally. So one, I think, very straightforward argument would be that Purim is different because Purim represents the eradication of Amalek, and that normally that's not the approach that we would take. We would say, but when it comes to destroying Amalek, you know, we take a very different approach. So that would sort of posit the opposite of what we've been saying until now. That would posit that Pesach is the more typical approach, and that we reserve the Purim model for really terrible depravity and evil. Okay. Verse number 5 is a little bit of splitting the difference, a little bit in the middle. And for this, I'd like to look at the two models of leadership that are contrasted between the Pesach story and the Purim story. So throughout Sefer Shemot, throughout the story of Mitzrayim, there's a real emphasis on the conflict between Hashem and Paro, more than between Hashem and Mitzrayim. Okay, so for example, we see in the Shemot Perek Aleph in source 18 that it's clear that the whole persecution is instituted specifically by Paro. Vayomer el Amo, he's like having to convince his people it's not like grassroots anti-Semitism. It's Paro is the mastermind behind this, and he needs to turn to his people and convince them. Havanit Chakmalo. And in Shemot Perek Dalid, when Hashem is telling Moshe the way that Yetziat Mitzrayim is going to unfold, it's very much like Hashem versus Paro, right? Ko Amar Hashem Bni B'chori Yisrael V'Omer Eilach HaShalach. He's telling him to say all this to Paro. Shalach Bni V'Yavdeni V'Tmein L'Shalcho Hineya Enochi Horeget V'Incha B'chorecha. Right, so it's all cast as like my B'chor Hashem versus your B'chor Paro. Ani Chazeket Libo. The idea of Chazkat Leiv Paro comes up, I think it's like 16 times or so throughout the story. And so clearly Paro is cast as the real problem here. And in fact, in source 20, you know, as we know, the Avdei Paro even turn to him during Barad, and they tell him that Terem Tedaki Avdei Mitzrayim, like, what's wrong with you? Don't you recognize this plan of yours is not working? Mitzrayim is being destroyed. So even in that case, it seems that Paro is the one who's really being stubborn and turning against Bnei Yisrael. And so I think one could argue that because that there are these different models of leadership, that because Paro was the mastermind and not his people as much, so we have more sympathy for his people, right? When they're the ones who are Tovan Bayam, they were really being manipulated by this very evil, cruel mastermind. And we sort of have some sympathy for them. We don't, like, not amazing sympathy, right? They had some choice in the matter. But at the same time, it's not like on Purim, where it's more of a sense of like a pogrom, you know, that there was permission to go out and destroy the Jewish people. And so it's 22, but I don't know exactly how these things work, but I would imagine that if someone didn't, it was not the same as if Paro's military turned against him. And there was probably more free choice in the matter. So it could be perhaps that really the distinction is not between Mitzrayim as a whole and between Pesach and Purim so much as between keeping responsible the person who's really responsible. So in the Pesach story, that was Paro, and we have more sympathy for his people. In the Purim story, we really don't, because the people who were involved were all people who chose to be involved. Okay, you could argue against me with source 21 that it does say that Ve'yafech levav paro va'avadav alham ve'yomru, that they all decided together to chase after Bnei Yisrael. You could make that, you know, that's possible, but I still think that overall there's a difference between sort of who's instigating the evil in the two stories and how that might play out with how we relate to the people as a whole.
It's okay.
You don't like it.
I was just following orders. You know,
right. Yeah, Inshliach HaDvar Avera. Right. So we'd say, like, they still had some choice.
Right.
So that's definitely, you know, that's certainly a weakness of it. Although, I think, again, we don't have so much Rachmanis on them, and they still drowned in the sea. Right. We still say Shira Sayam. We're just maybe... we have a little bit more sympathy for them. Like, I think we would have a little more sympathy for someone who said, I was just following orders, not a huge amount, but as opposed to, like, someone who was the mastermind, right? Yeah. So perhaps it's tempered a little bit. Yeah,
but,
go ahead.
But by Purim, it was the Am?
So it's not 100% the Am, but I think it is in two senses. One is that the initiative comes from Haman and not from the king. That's clear. So it's not that they're following the orders of their king that they must listen to the way that Mitzrayim had to listen to Paro. And also that because it was this general, you know, permission, everyone can go out, or even order, that everyone can go out and kill Jews on this day. But I don't think it's exactly the same as having a military that needs to follow orders. I think there was more initiative that was, I imagine, could be wrong, that was needed on the part of individuals to want to be part of this. Okay? So I think those are the five approaches that I thought of about this. Yeah, go ahead, please.
Can I give you number six?
Please. That's what I mean.
Masaya Daitovim Bayam could be that he's not even speaking about the Egyptians. I was not happy that Goering was hanged because my family was destroyed. Mm-hmm. So I get no hanor from that. Mm-hmm. Proving Jews were not killed. Masaya Daitovim Bayam, and you're so happy. These little children were thrown into the Nile, the Jewish children. So killing the Mitzrim, to me, does not create any happiness. Mm-hmm. Destroying Nasser before he was able to destroy Israel in 1967 created happiness for me. Mm-hmm. That's my number seven.
There you go. Interesting. Yes, please.
Can I give number seven?
Please.
I have a more overarching look at this. Maybe it's a conglomeration of all the different approaches. But that Judaism is very much about dialectic. Mm-hmm. Things are, life is complex, values are complex. And if you look at Pesach itself, so you have matzah, you have morah, you have abdus, you have chavis, you always have things that are conflicting with each other. So there are two valid approaches to enemies being destroyed. And what the two stories are telling us is that there are these two valid approaches, and you, Jewish people, when you're confronted with evil, when you're confronted with enemies, you have to make a choice by yourself. God is not saying, this is the easy answer. What God is saying is there are no easy answers. And you're going to have to decide when you're confronted with evil, which model, and I've given you two models, but now it's up to you to decide which model to follow as you confront evil, as you
Right. And I think that approach makes sense, and I think it also fits in with some of these, meaning these might be some of the elements you would consider when deciding which approach to have.
Right. Any of them into consideration, and these
right.
are the things
All
that,
of these things might play
and,
into
and,
it.
And we have to do it. Mm-hmm. Because both models are valid.
Right. That makes sense. Okay. I want to look together at one last idea, which is from Rabbi Meir Soloveitchik's article, The Virtue of Hate. In his article, as a whole, he takes the approach that Purim, that what we've construed as the Purim model, is really more normative when dealing with really serious national enemies. And he brings a few proofs. First, he brings Purim, but he also brings Shirat Devorah after the destruction of Sisera. He brings Shimshon, right, bringing down the house. And so his conclusion is that when we have an enemy who's like truly wicked, then having a certain feeling of hatred or being happy in their destruction is appropriate. And I want to look at it together and see. I think he actually is assuming implicitly one of the models that we suggested, but we can also like talk about his approach in general. So I'll just read it. It's a couple paragraphs. The Protestant theologian Harvey Cox, who was married to a Jew, wrote a book on his impressions of Jewish ritual. Cox described the Jewish holiday of Purim, on which the defeat of Haman is celebrated by the reading of the Book of Esther. Enamored with the biblical story, Cox enjoys the tale until the end, where, as noted above, Esther wreaks vengeance upon her enemies. And so he goes on to say that that this was troublesome to him. I'm going to turn to the next page. Okay, so he says at the top of the second page, he quotes our Gemara, and then he says, yet the rabbis also state that God wreaked further vengeance upon Paro himself, ordering the sea to spit him out so that he could return to Egypt alone without his army. Apparently, one must cross some terrible moral boundary in order to be a justified target of God's hatred and of ours. And he discusses some other dangers of hating people. But then he says, neither does this mean that hate is always wrong, nor that Esther's actions were unnecessary. The rabbis of the Talmud were bothered by a contradiction. The Book of Kings described Saul as killing every Amalekite, and yet Haman was a descendant of the Amalekite king. And he goes on to explain how the Gemara solves that and says that Agag had relations with a woman right after Shaul didn't kill him. And then he concludes, the message is that hate allows us to keep our guard up to protect us. When we are facing those who seek nothing but our destruction, our hate reminds us who we are dealing with. When hate is appropriate, then it is not only virtuous but essential for Jewish well-being. So, in general, this is actually the only treatment that he gives at all to the Pesach story within the article. He focuses much more on the Purim article and the Purim idea. But it seems to me that he's adopting implicitly one of our approaches, which is that Paro was the source of the problem, right? Because he says that he quotes Chazal that Paro suffered more. But that it wasn't appropriate for Bnei Yisrael to exult in the destruction of their enemies. So I think that that's what he's assuming, that it was only Paro who had crossed that moral line to become someone so evil that we should rejoice in his destruction, whereas the rest of the Mitzrayim were bad, but we shouldn't have that same emotion, and we have a little bit more sympathy for them. I mean, I think his premise is, you know, interesting. It's certainly arguable. I'm not sure that, like, Shimshon is meant to be the kind of paradigm that he suggests, but, you know, it certainly works to bring these three ideas together. But I also just think it's interesting to see how he seems to be adopting one of our approaches. Okay, curious if anyone has a approach eight or a reaction to one of them that we've discussed. Yeah, go ahead.
Comment. Look, I'm known as the Bab Harvey Cox, mm-hmm. but obviously he knows very little or doesn't want to know that for 1,600 years, his people, Christians, persecuted and created and promoted hatred for mm-hmm. 1,600 years against Jews. So he's upset that the Jews took vengeance on the enemies. In fact, the Jews were defending themselves because once the edict went out to destroy the Jews, the laws of Persia did not commit a contradiction. So the edict went out, and it was free for mm-hmm. everyone to destroy Jews. So the Jews were fighting to save their lives. I wouldn't say they took vengeance. Mm-hmm. No one would say they took vengeance. They were simply fighting to save their lives. Mm-hmm. So this Harvey Cox
right.
is a hypocrite. Absolutely hypocrite.
Okay. Other reactions? You have a favorite with a number eight? Okay. All right. Well, that was what I wanted to present to you. I hope that was interesting going into Purim to think about those different models. And again, thank you for learning with me. Have a good Shabbos.
Thank you very much. Next week is Rabbi Eli Rubin. After that is Dr. Berger. And then we enter into pre-Pesach.
Are we going to start tomorrow
now? 9:15.
9:15.
Thank you.
9:15.
9:15. Oh, 1:50. Oh, very good.